Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again.
And the Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits by Unknown Tome. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
This is Robert J. Schwab, the Prince of Darkness of Gaming, and I'm here on the Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And our guest for this episode is Quinn Murphy. Quinn, welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, it's been a while. It's good to be back.
It's always good to have the incomparable Quinn Murphy on The Tome Show.
Good to be here, definitely.
We've got a couple of news topics to discuss before we get into the main bit of our episode today, but today we are reviewing the book Heroes of Shadow. Let's start off with the news, though.
So the first item is with Heroes of Shadow, they're now releasing the content to DDI the same day they release it to all stores, which is kind of interesting. What do you guys think of that?
It's pretty much awesome.
Yeah.
The premier stores still get the book like 10 days early. So you can get the book then, and it hasn't gotten anywhere else yet. But 10 days later, it hits all the other stores, and DDI is updated at the same time, which makes a lot of sense in my head, given how long it takes them to produce these books. Like, the content's been there in their hands probably for months. So it's not like a lack of time. It's not like they needed the time to get it into DDI, especially now with the slowdown of content. You know, they've talked about how they're not producing as many books now. It seems like a no-brainer. It seems like it makes me think, well, that's awesome. And why didn't they do it before? But even more so, it's awesome.
Yeah, I felt like at the sort of torrent of content they were putting out before, I think it made it really difficult. And also they were, you know, with the older character builder, I think, you know, I mean, part of the reason they switched was the data entry it seemed like it got sort of snarly after a while. And hard to do. So, you know, I think if you're releasing stuff all the time, it's hard to do. But if you slow it down, you can just get fewer things done better. Mm-hmm. So we can get the book. We can wait 10 days, you know, and 10 days was way better than, you know, sometimes the month or two or more mm-hmm. that we were waiting to get the DDI content after. So I can wait 10 days after I get the book at a premier store to do that. So that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaking about the changes in the character builder, I think one of the other differences is that if you start making people download updates constantly, you're going to rub some people the wrong way. But because it's now a web app, I mean, they could update it continuously. You know, they could be updating, doing little updates, you know, add a feat here and there sort of updates every single day, and it wouldn't mm-hmm. make a huge difference. You know, to what people are doing. So, I mean, you even with articles on Dungeon & Dragon, they could be running those updates for it as the articles come out, you know, assuming that their schedule allows them to, you know, without making people go through the process of updating their software.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tracy, you have any thoughts on it?
I like it, particularly after what happened with Dark Sun.
Yeah. Yes. My only question on the whole thing is, does this further push Dungeons and Dragons into the digital space? You know, this seems, you know, at least before, you could argue Wizards was giving a little more support to the published product, encouraging people to buy the published product because they could get their hands on it earlier, sometimes months earlier. Is there now more argument to say, well, I don't need to buy any more books, I'll just get a DDI subscription?
I mean, personally, I'm sort of I might be, in a certain sense, the wrong guy to ask because I'm a junkie, so I'm just going to buy the book. And then I also am going to have the DDI subscription. Mm-hmm. You know, me personally, I just like supporting, you know, the particular things I like in the hobby and like buying all this other stuff. And I think anybody who feels like me doesn't really care. But I mean, I think in terms of sort of when people are looking at it more as a value proposition, like where am I going to get maximum value in the game? I think you might get maximum value as long as you're getting maximum value out of DDI, but a lot of people don't feel comfortable with the digital end of things and would like the hard copy.
I always have this little niggling fear in the back of my head that, you know, D&D may not be profitable for Hasbro someday, and the whole brand just goes away. You know, but I'll always have those published books, even if the website shuts down.
Right.
It doesn't seem likely, and I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not bringing back my 5th editions on its way fears again. But my books I'll have forever. An online service, I may not.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, I think that it could be really useful for them and to have more people subscribe to DDI, and that might be one reason to do this. The other thing is, you know, there are certain things that they'll put in the books that they don't put in DDI, and if those are worth it enough, then, you know, people are going to buy the books.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I've always felt like one thing that the book should emphasize and overall is sort of the flavor and fluff more. I mean, I think that is real, you know, because that's something that, you know, the more of that there is in there, because you don't really get that on the compendium there, you know, you might get it in some of the articles and stuff. I think focusing on that to bring more sort of texture to it is also probably a good idea too.
And I think honestly, it's not necessarily a bad business decision for them to try to encourage people to get DDI accounts, because that's income they know is coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a subscription-based income, they know it's coming. And if they have a down month or two, you're probably not going to lose a lot of subscriptions because of it. Whereas if you have a down book, you may have published a bunch of books that didn't sell, and that's a problem, you know? The downside, of course, of that is that none of the local gaming stores are prospering on DDI sales. So
yeah.
But I think, all in all, I'm very pleased with the release at this point. And as far as what it may or may not do to the industry, I don't know. We'll see. One thing I'm less pleased with, I think, is the next bit of news where we don't have Fighters and Warlords anymore. They've renamed the Player's Handbook 1 classes. The Fighter is now the Weapon Master, and the Warlord is now the Marshal.
Yeah, it's not so much I like or dislike it, I am just confused. Like, you know, it's sort of, you know, I feel like things are all a swirl in there, you know. I envision sort of this, like, if someone who is new to the game, you know, someone comes in tomorrow and then we're talking and I was like, oh, and Fighters, and they're like, what? You know, and I was like, oh, and the Fighters, oh, you know, oh, you mean the Weapon Master, right? You know, like, you know, that it could just be confusing terminology-wise.
Well, I think they did it to try to clear things up, actually, because Essentials named things differently. And so I sort of felt like, I'm guessing they made the changes, and somebody correct me if they've read differently, but I'm under the impression they made the changes to make us people who are coming into the game through Essentials, helping them transition into Player's Handbook 1 and those kinds of classes a little more easily, to recognize those things a little more easily. Because, I mean, if you look at it in the character builder right now, it now says Weapon Master parentheses Fighter, Marshal parentheses Warlord. Just like, you know, the knight says knight parentheses, what is it, fighter or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, part of me says, for the first time in the history of Dungeons & Dragons, we don't have a class called a fighter, but we kind of do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of a lame excuse for naming a class a fighter.
Yeah.
I mean, I know why there are legacy reasons for keeping a fighter class, but it's kind of a hard class to name that way, given how broad that term can be. But my understanding is one of the big reasons that they renamed them, particularly, you know, the Weapon Master and the Marshal, was that there are going to be certain feats that should only apply to them, and maybe certain other ones or powers or whatnot that shouldn't, and to make it easier to distinguish. Mm-hmm. Because if you just say this is a fighter feat, but really it should be, you know, for non-essentials fighters, that's very hard to convey without these more narrow titles.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's essential to. I was gonna say, pardon the pun, yeah, but it's pretty vital to, like you're saying, get rid of those. So you can stop saying essentials, non-essentials. You have to pick one naming schema, and then put everyone on it.
Right.
And yeah, I sort of feel like we just had Crisis on Infinite Earths, and they've retconned my D&D. That's a comic book reference, people.
And it's going to be important too when they start bringing out even more of the class compendium stuff about, you know, things that you can use across classes.
Yeah. I still wish there was a more, I don't know, elegant or respectful way to handle it. But, you know, you made the point earlier, it's just a name.
I know, and people get attached to names.
But if it's just a name, then it shouldn't be that hard to keep it. And, you know, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the problem is they painted themselves in the corner with making a fighter class that had those subclasses in essentials, those builds.
So what you're telling me is that all those people who said essentials is ruining my D&D were actually right, and you can't make the argument of, well, just don't play essentials, because now essentials is affecting everything else.
It only affects it as much as you want to, and it's not ruining my D&D, so... But I understand the nostalgia value and everything. I really do. Like, I'm not trying to argue that part of it. I'm just saying, like, it does make some sense. I think it's more unfortunate that we went down that road to begin with in calling them fighters. Because I don't know about the fighter, but I know the rogue, for instance, had the Artful Dodger and the Brutal Scoundrel builds to start with. And if we had... that's where Essentials gets their things from. If we had started from the beginning... referring to builds by that it would have made things a lot easier, I think.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not sold, but...
You don't have to be.
I'll survive. I'm not... And you know what? The Warlord doesn't bother me as much because it doesn't have that nostalgia, I guess.
It's not as iconic.
Yeah, but, I mean, when I think D&D classes, it's fighter, it's wizard.
Right.
You know? And although that's not even fair, is it? Because it wasn't wizard, it was magic user. So, really, fighter is one of the few classes that hasn't undergone at least the name changes over the editions, and now apparently it hasn't survived either. It was, like all good fighters, the steady rock in the middle of my party.
That hits things with swords.
That hits things with... All right. Anyway, we should move along.
Today we'll be talking a little bit about the Shadowfell with Heroes of Shadows. But before that, it's time to talk about Noble Knight Games, a game store where you'll find darn near everything new or out of print. Our fic for this episode is Heroes of Shadow, and you can find a link in the show notes at thetomeshow.com.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, so we are back. We are talking about Player's Option Heroes of Shadow. Let's see, on the covers, Mike Merles, Claudio Posis, and Robert J. Schwab. Let's go through this book a little bit and see what's in it and see what we like and see what we don't like and try to figure out who should buy it and who shouldn't buy it. There's only, what, 4 chapters in the whole book. There's essentially the fluff chapter, the classes chapter, the races chapter, and then the other stuff chapter, which includes feats and paragon paths and epic destinies and all that. So let's open up with our fluff chapter. It's, what, about 10, 12 pages? And talking about, you know, how shadow and shadow magic and all that kind of stuff could play a role into your game or your character. What do we think? Is the fluff good?
It's decent. It's a good sort of start just talking about touching around trying to sort of orient you into the stuff. I would have liked just a little more, just sort of for it to like lead in a little more directly, like maybe talk to some of the classes in sort of their roles within the shadow. Think a little more, although they talk about that some in the classes themselves, but a little intro would have been cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my sort of general impression was that when the fluff was good, it was good. And when it wasn't really good, it was largely forgettable. You know? I really liked the spelling out some of the ideas in the, was it the Lure of Shadow? At the end of the section where it talks about, you know, these are the kinds of ways that you could tempt. You could actually integrate the concept of shadow into your storyline and have, you know, the Raven Queen or whoever your god of death is sort of tempt a character and integrate this into your story. And you know, I thought there were some neat ideas there that sort of inspired some ideas for me. But most of the rest of it before that was like either really high up academic to the point that they weren't specific enough that it gave me much inspiration, or at some points even redundant. Like there were whole sections where they were just quoting fake books that didn't necessarily inspire me or tell me anything about using shadow power. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I look at it as sort of a, when I think of, you know, you could give me a book called Heroes of Shadow, I think instantly, rightly or wrongly, of a book of sort of anti-heroes, right? Mm-hmm. And so then in the intro chapter, I sort of wanted to see more, less sort of background, because I've already got, you know, if you've gotten here this far, you know, sort of been playing 4E a while, you have a sense of what the Shadowfell is, and you want to sort of get more to, like, what am I playing, like, as a hero based within the sort of shadow itself? How am I playing this sort of gritty anti-hero who's influenced by the shadow? Like, more character-driven, in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things to consider is that this is going to be maybe the first non-essentialist book that people who came in through essentials are going to pick up. So while a invested 4E player will know a lot about the Shadowfell and what it means and things like that, not everyone necessarily would. And I know I still had some issues with that because, I mean, I've read through some of the other books, but I needed something more like this book to try to understand it because I felt like a lot of the other ones, I just thought that it was referencing some other third or earlier edition stuff that I just didn't know. And this one seemed to be a little more concrete for me in that way. But I could see how somebody who knew that stuff already would be like, well, why am I reading this? This is, you know, this is covered in this other book sort of thing.
Well, and I guess I didn't even necessarily feel like that, like, why am I reading this? It's already been covered. I just sort of felt like, why am I reading this? It's not giving me, I don't know, it's not really, when I'm reading fluff, the whole point is to find things that inspire you creatively, either as a DM or as a, you know, as a player. And a lot of it didn't do that, you know, it just felt largely uninspired.
Okay.
When it was on, it was really good. You know, I don't want to say that the people who wrote the fluff weren't with it, but I think going back to our earlier conversation, analyzing the fluff has become more important when reviewing D&D books.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fluff is the difference between buying the book and getting just a DDI account.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
One thing I did find interesting is that for a player options book, there seemed to be a lot of more stuff aimed at the DM in it, which I just thought was interesting. Like, the Raven Queen's offer, in some ways, is very DM-driven, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is. Although, part of me wonders if maybe some of this stuff makes more sense when the Shadowfell book or box set comes out for DMs. You know, sort of how you've got the campaign guide for the Forgotten Realms and you got the player's guide. You know, maybe this is just the player's guide version and you're going to get all the stuff that I'm looking for in the box set you're on.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually, because I could see that happening. This is sort of like the warm-up,
right,
for like the full detail in there. I really liked, I just want to second that, I loved the Raven Queen's Whisper. Pretty much, to me, my favorite part of the first section there, just in terms of talking about, you know, what I hope to see more of. I would have liked to have done a few things like at the end of this chapter, just because I think it's good for people to see, especially if you're coming, you know, you're just starting off with essentials and you're getting sort of into more of the other stuff. It's good to see some of these examples of things of using the story to drive mechanics. Like I think there's this sort of common thing that people believe that 4E is only mechanic driven, and you know, like if it's not in the, you know, if it's not explicitly stated in the rules, then you can't use it in your story. But that's not really true, and stuff like this gives a good example of stuff that's story driven, and then you create rules for.
And some of it doesn't even necessarily create rules for, right?
It's right, like, yeah.
You know, you could just simply have a situation where, you know what, you're about to have a TPK. Every single player is about to die. And this is an example of how you can use story to fix that situation and continue moving things forward. And there's still consequences. You know, the whole party's about to die, and the Raven Queen says, you know what, I have a job for you. I will save you and your party if you promise to do some things for me. Mm-hmm. And then they pull you out of that TPK. And then put you in a situation that allows you to, you know, manipulate things for the Raven Queen or for her, you know, goals. And that's just good storytelling in a role-playing game.
Right.
You know, there's no mechanics there. It's just telling people, giving some people some ideas about how to use certain themes and certain ideas to keep their story moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
All right. Should we move on to chapter two?
Sure.
Let's rock.
Shadow classes.
Woohoo.
We have a bunch of new options. We have a new assassin build. We have a new paladin build. We have an entirely new class thing, and as well as some new stuff for the warlock and the new options in general at the end there. So let's go through bit by bit. Executioner assassin. What do we think?
Lethal.
Yeah.
These things are nasty. It's cool class. And they're just really vicious. I feel sorry for the original assassin.
My power gamer seemed unimpressed with the damage output of the assassin, the executioner assassin. But at the same time, when you start adding in the poisons, and then you start realizing that, you know, by paragon tier, once you knock something down to 20 hit points, it just dies.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty killer. I mean, that can add up to some pretty serious mojo there. I think the most unfortunate thing about this new build is the name. Because I sort of feel like it's not executioner, I know it's just a name, Tracy, but executioner is not a name that to me describes what this guy is. Assassin, it does. But I don't picture this person as an executioner so much as I do an assassin. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Executioner sort of calls to me sort of, hey, look, you know, your head's on the chopping block. I've got a huge axe.
Right, exactly.
You know, and I'm going to lop it off. Right. Yeah, that's true. Now, one interesting thing with the assassin for me, I will try not to harp on this excessively, but it's been something that's been sort of floating around my head a lot lately, because you hear it a lot in terms of 4E. You know, they never, you know, everything's combat all the time. Everything's combat all the time now. I just want to point out distinctly here in a lot of the poisons for the assassin, they'll like have a combat use, and then they'll have a sort of, now you're cooking with poison effect.
Right.
You know, and an explicit non-combat use.
And I found the poison to be an interesting mechanic in other ways too, because you have an essentials build. You know, if you want to delineate between core D&D and essentials D&D, or however you want to call it, and it's absolutely an essentials build, right? It's based on you get what, a bunch of utilities that you get to choose from, and everything else is these three at wills that you can pick at the beginning of level one. You know, there's not a lot of ways to, you're not picking a bunch of dailies and encounter powers, but you still get a decent number of variety of options because, you know, you start gaining all these poisons that you can add to your at-will powers. And so you can mix and match, and it's a way of getting options without necessarily doing it in the same way by just adding more powers like you have in other classes. So I found it interesting. I found it's maybe not as complex as the original core classes from Player's Handbook 1 and 2, but it's definitely more complex and more interesting in terms of choices than the Essentials Fighter and the Essentials Rogue.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know Tracy's a big fan of those two classes. So.
Yeah, I love those. The other thing I like about the assassin is just like, this is really, you get down and dirty, like you're grabbing the guy and you're choking him and things like that, that are just, I think, easier to describe than some of the other attacks that some of the other classes have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to the Blackguard Paladin. It's been sort of historical or going back to previous conversations, nostalgic to have sort of a fallen paladin concept in D&D. And this is the build that they've given us to do that with. And it changes the paladin from a defender to a striker. And what do we think?
I also think that the Blackguard's pretty cool, too. I mean, it's, you know, like you said, it's sort of a tradition to sort of, you know, the paladin's always been the nicest guy nobody likes. You know, and then the Blackguard is always, you know, or fallen paladin has always been the meanest guy everybody thinks is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it sort of delivers on that sort of promise of making sort of a guy dedicated to, instead of virtue, vice, and sort of channeling their black powers through, mm-hmm. you know, through that. It's kind of cool.
Tracy, thoughts?
I like the vices. I want to see them play with that more.
There should be more vices, yeah.
Yeah. Fury just doesn't do it for me. Well,
and in the same way, I mean, with the assassin, too, there should be more poisons as well. That would make things a lot more interesting. But we're just being introduced to these concepts, and there's time to add that kind of stuff later, hopefully.
Yeah.
So that's it? You like vices?
Yeah, so on one hand, that whole anti-hero thing that Quinn was talking about, like, really appeals to me. I don't know if this is quite what I'd want to play is the only thing. I kind of read it and was like, okay, it's cool.
I have sort of this long history of wanting to pull off a fallen paladin character, but mechanically have never felt like I could do it. You know, even in previous editions, when you became the fallen paladin, there were some serious consequences to the point that you were practically unplayable.
Right. Yeah, you got hit with a nerf hammer pretty hard.
Yeah. This, I guess, makes it playable or possible, but not particularly, not in a hugely interesting way. Like, maybe I'm beyond that. I don't know. Maybe I've just grown up and that angsty sort of fallen paladin concept doesn't appeal to me anymore. But the Blackguard looks fine. It looks solid. It looks, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't look like it's my thing, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
I don't know. Maybe I've just grown up. And remind me here now, is the paladin, the Blackguard paladin is built like an essentials class?
Yes.
Sometimes it's hard to tell because they've just started organizing everything the same way they did essentials now. So I can't tell if it's just the way it looks because of the organization or if it's actually an essentials class. But it doesn't get the encounter powers and stuff. It has daily powers and it has at-will powers and utilities. That's essentials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another character concept that I used to be really, really into that I sort of feel like I'm over is the next class, which is probably in many ways, one of the most interesting things they did in the book, I think, because they decided to finally make it so you can play a vampire.
Yes.
But they did it by creating a vampire class.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think it's a really interesting way of handling that has some consequences, both good and bad. Because on one hand, it means I can now make a vampire from other races, right? Which makes sense. That, you know, I could be a halfling vampire or, you know, a Deva vampire or whatever. Which makes a lot of sense. It also does, I think, a really good job of scaling vampire powers, right? The more levels you gain in your vampire class, the more awesome vampire-ish powers you gain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you could pull off a vampire in a party pretty darn well with this. The problem is, I don't think you could pull off more than one.
Well, that would be funny given its mechanic for gaining healing surges.
It would be the vampiric version of swapping spin.
But even beyond that, if you've got a big enough party, you can get around the whole healing surge problem. The issue is that there's virtually no choice when building a vampire. Vampires are almost going to be identical. There's very few choices. I mean, throughout the entire heroic tier, you make one choice, and that's for this utility power or the other utility power at level mm-hmm. 2. And after that, there's no choices. Paragon tier is very similar. And then epic tier, you get to choose an epic destiny. And so obviously that's going to give different choices there as well. So you can have, I mean, if you have more than one vampire in a party, mechanically, they're going to be very similar. I mean, the only differentiation is those few little choices and feats. And that's it. Otherwise, they're identical. All their powers are the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I really would have liked to... I like how they built it out as a class. I really would have loved to have seen this as a theme. I don't know if they had made the decision to start, you know, doing more theme stuff mm-hmm. when they were developing this book, though. But, man, to see a vampire theme would have made me so happy because it solves a lot of those problems. I get to play a vampire. I get to play something. I get to play a vampire, a halfling vampire. And mm-hmm. I get the distinction of class, right? So I can have, like, an elf vampire, you know, rogue. Which, you know, there's nothing more fun in D&D than stacking a bunch of nouns and adjectives on top of each other. And then that would let me really do that and go all the way with it. Vampires as a class just feels really, really strange. I mean, it's totally playable. It's totally playable, but it's weird.
And I think you could totally – I mean, I could see myself playing a vampire. I just don't think I could have more than one in a group.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, I think, and I think that's fine. I think, it, I mean, I think the way they put it together works really well. And I think even with a theme, that would you could do it that way. There would be some other little problems, like because the way they built it out, you can actually get some of the really cool, you know, really badass vampire powers that you've seen in the movies and whatever, and that's awesome, you know. And it, it's harder to do that with themes because themes aren't quite as powerful as classes. If you take my mechanical meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you could definitely do it as a theme, as a compromise. But I feel like as a class, you can do it better. It's just you don't get a lot of variety, which maybe that's okay.
Well, like maybe, I mean, you don't get a lot of variety for now. Maybe it was aimed at more people newer to D&D who wanted to play something else other than what was in the Essentials books. Because I mean, a vampire is something that most people know what it is, even if you haven't read a lot of fantasy itself. And I also felt like it had to be a class because some of the other stuff that I thought was really awesome and cool, like the Child of the Night part and the healing surges and just things like that, I think would have been hard to do with a theme.
Okay, so anyway, that's the vampire in a nutshell, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we think it's really cool. It doesn't have a lot of variety, but maybe that's not horrible,
right? Yeah,
and remember your cloak.
Yes, yeah, you will. It is interesting. It's the only class that will let you get killed by sunlight.
Yes,
yeah,
which I actually thought was kind of.
But it's not cool. Hard. But it's actually they make it not very hard to get around.
Yeah, yeah, it's easy, I mean, to get around.
It's just wear your hood. You know, you're good.
Right. But for some people, they really love that sort of detail and stuff. So I'm glad they're adding it in. Maybe this wasn't the best example ever, but it's great that it's in here and yeah. People can start playing with that aspect of the game, too.
I absolutely agree. All right. The next class or next build is a new build of Warlock called the Binder, making the Warlock into an arcane controller. Has anybody else noticed that? Since the new leadership has sort of moved in and some of the older, and it's hard to say old guard when it comes to 4th edition, right? But when some of the old guard folks, 4th edition, have gone elsewhere, the strict adherence to the concept of roles has been fairly thoroughly muddied. Like every new build we have, with the exception of the Executioner, takes a class and gives it a different role. You know, this Warlock is a controller. Mm-hmm. The paladin becomes a striker. But in any case, the new warlock is a binder. And the idea is that it's getting, instead of making a pact with an entity, it's sort of summoning stuff all the time and making pacts with all these little, you know, demons and devils or things from beyond. Does that sort of describe it?
Yep.
Yeah.
It is also following the Essentials line of builds. So, you know, people can take that into effect. It's also at least halfway. It sort of plays the game of the one thing in the book that doesn't really belong, you know, because it's a new build of Warlock, but only marginally has anything to do with Shadow.
Well, I mean, it's got the Gloom Pact. Therefore, the Star Pact that it brings with it is sort of not shadowy. But
right. So the class itself is non-shadowy. The build itself is non-shadowy, but one specific pact is kind of shadowy. So, yeah. I mean, I guess that's how they justify it. But so what do we think? Good, bad, indifferent?
It's okay. That was maybe one of the ones that was sort of least catchy for me.
Mm-hmm.
The one I played at DDXP it was interesting, and you know, it like talking to the spirits that surround you is kind of a cool role playing thing, but I'm not sure how much I'd play it again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm relatively indifferent on the whole thing. Like the idea of a binder or a summoner class is appealing to me. The idea of making it a warlock rather than a wizard is also appealing to me, or interesting in terms of design. But at the same time, this class, I don't know, didn't really grab my attention either. It seems fine. It didn't seem bad. It just doesn't seem like something that inspires me to play.
Yeah, and I think it would have been cool if they played up the shadows even more than they did. You know, give you some knacks or something that you can use with it. I didn't see them, but I could be misremembering.
All right, well, let's move on to what is possibly the coolest part, actually, of the whole class section, and that's the miscellaneous section, where it just sort of lists other classes, which isn't even necessarily an appropriate name to cover some of the classes that were already covered, like Warlock. I thought this was the section that was actually, in my opinion, probably the coolest. You know, it opens up with, like, the cleric, and it just says, you know, here are more cleric powers that go in the vein or follow the theme of shadow. And then they do the coolest thing, which is they show you that with only a handful of pages, they can support the core cleric and an essentials cleric.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't take up a ton of space, but they've now said, here's how you can infuse your cleric with shadow, whether you're playing an essentials cleric or a non-essentials cleric. They do the same thing with warlock. They do the same thing with wizard. And I thought that was awesome. Like, the idea that they could very simply and effectively support the class, regardless of it, whether it's essentials or not, in a cool and interesting way, I thought was really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very nice. You know, it's just, I mean, like, you know, nice sort of grab bag of powers for pretty much what clerics, warlocks, and wizards are the only ones who get love on that, right?
Right. Although you get extra love for the wizard because you're actually getting two builds. You can necromancer, or two sets of powers, necromancy and ethermancy. But yeah, I thought it was really cool. And it's sort of, it gives you the concept of a theme without giving you the limitations of a theme, right? As I'm building my wizard, I can choose these powers, or you know what? I cannot choose these powers, but I now have these options that can help me flavor my character in that way. And the more I pick up those kinds of powers, the more my character feels like a necromancer or whatever.
Right.
So, I don't know. I thought that was by far my, maybe not the most interesting thing they did in the classes chapter, but I thought probably the best thing they did in the classes was just that ending section on giving you a bunch of those options. That was cool. All right, should we move on to races?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Our first race is the one we already had. We've had if you have a DDI account, you've had a Revenant for a while now. And I don't know, I didn't play, or I haven't played a Revenant before. Did it go through many changes?
It's been a while since I looked at one hardcore. I don't believe it did.
Yeah,
but so. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I had a guy play one, but I don't know enough about the old one.
So, I mean, a Revenant, for anybody who's not a DDI subscriber or hasn't kept up on it, is basically... actually, one of the interesting things it is, and one of the others of the new races is the same way, is I think they talk about it as it's sort of a transformative race, because what happens is your character dies, but for whatever reason clings to life and comes back as a Revenant, which is sort of your undead character sort of guy. You know, in the same way that a Warforged is a construct, a Revenant is an undead. It's sort of the crow of D&D. If you want to put it into those terms. And you know what? I was hesitant on the concept. I wasn't a big fan of the concept of the Revenant. And then the opportunity came up to bring one into my own campaign. And it made, I mean, the story made a lot of sense. And it happened. And it's worked really well. And it helped do some things for my campaign. So, I mean, I'm not going to poo-poo the idea of the Revenant because it's worked really well for me. So I think there's room for that.
Yeah, the Revenants, I've never been... I think they're cool enough, but, you know, it's good to see them here, but Yeah, I'm a lot more excited about some of the other races than I was about The Revenant.
I think my only disappointment of The Revenant is that we've already had it. Like, I feel like I paid for it twice. Because I got it on DDI, and then I got it here. Mm-hmm. And it's not like the Executioner Assassin, where they sort of gave us the beta version on DDI and said, you know, we're testing this out, and then we played it, and then they fixed it and changed it. You know, the printed version is different than the online version. But The Revenant, that's not really the case, I don't think. Mm-hmm. The next race is probably the one that, at least in terms of story, interests me the most. Probably in the whole book. And that's The Shade. It's another transformative race where, you know, maybe you're a human or whatever, and you've made some sort of pact to trade part of your soul with the essence of shadow, and you've become a shade. I think part of my interest in that is because I'm a big Forgotten Realms fan, and there's a whole empire made up of shades. And now I have a mechanic to do that and play my character from that evil society who may or may not actually be evil and follow their ways. You know, I sort of feel like Shade is the new Drow.
Really?
Yeah. In my headspace, yeah.
Interesting. I like the Shades a lot. I don't know if I could put them in that same space, I mean, myself conceptually, but I really liked them. And one thing I really liked, one of the things that interests me about both the Shades and the next guys we're going to cover is they do this nifty little thing with them now where they give you sort of your different attributes and traits for your race and then your racial power, but then they give you a list of utility replacement ones. Like, so the race also acts as sort of a mini theme itself, so you can replace your utility powers that you would normally get for your class with the Shade utility powers, which I thought was a really nifty conceptual mechanical.
I don't think that's necessarily something that they should do or plan to do or need to do with all the other races as well. You know, on one hand, yeah, this helps you feel more like a shade, right? You can be more or less shade depending on how many of these powers you take. Or you can do the same thing with dwarves, right? You can be more or less dwarven depending on how many of these utility powers you take or whatever. But on the other hand, there is a mechanical trade-off, you know? Their actual attributes don't seem that awesome, except they get access to all these cool utility powers too.
Right.
And so that sort of makes up for any mechanical shortfalls they may otherwise have. Shall we move on?
Sure.
All right. Tracy, pronounce the next one for me.
I have no idea.
Vryloka? How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Can we establish officially, can the Tome Show be the official pronunciator of D&D names that otherwise don't have pronunciations, and we're going to go ahead and call this the Vryloka?
Yeah, you can be that person.
Awesome. Wow, I feel special. You know what, Tracy? You can take the rest of the show. That's just going to be my job now, is being the pronunciator.
Nice.
So, Tracy, tell us about the Vryloka.
They're vampires with a different name.
Yeah, that's kind of... I mean, they're half vampires.
Yeah, they just don't have the undead element, I believe. They're still living, right?
They're living dead. So they work like the Revenant does. They're both living and undead.
Right, but they don't have the taint of undeath, is how they put it in the fluff.
Yeah, it was sort of like they're not vampires. They're just some people that made a deal with some sort of entity.
Yeah.
That made them into vampire-ish things.
Which is kind of cool. I don't know. These in the Shades, I guess I just don't know enough about the Shadowfell to know what these are supposed to be like. So I was like okay with them. I think they like the classes better than the races, but
yeah, honestly, the Vryloka is one of the things that interests me the least in the book. Mechanically, it's fun, I guess, but I mean, I feel like as much as the vampire is so like two editions ago, and the Drow is so one last edition, the half vampire is just as I'm kind of just as over that, and especially because we've already done it like twice in this edition. Because we have this, and we have the damn fear, and we've got vampire class as a class now as well. So I sort of feel like okay, the vampire thing's been done, and it's a little tired.
We have to convert the Twilight people.
Yeah, didn't the Vryloka sparkle? Just joking. Yeah, but I mean,
they do it in my game now.
You know, it's funny because the Vrier Loca, when I saw them, it was like you ever have just, you know, you're working on a campaign or something creative, and then there's like some little gap there, and you're not fretting the gap, you know, but you're present, you're mindful that it's there and that it's present, and then something comes along and you're like, oh, I'm gonna put that right there. Like when I saw the Vrier Loca, basically it took me a minute to read them, and I was like, oh, this fits right in my current campaign pretty snugly into a couple of spots there. So I'm just, you know, going to lift them that. If I didn't have that gap, I don't know if I'd feel so amicable about them, but since they have a spot, it's really pretty awesome.
But that's a fair point, because we're only a few people and everybody's playing a different game, right? Mm-hmm. So different people have different gaps and different people have different things they need to make their campaign awesome. So
yeah.
This might seem really strange, but to me they almost feel like human Aladrin, like the human version of Aladrin. So
yeah, because there's that vampire royalty sort of thing. You know, there's sort of royal dampier vampire kind of thing. So that's going to be the role that they take in my campaign, is sort of these like undead sort of degenerate rulers of kind of stuff, like the sort of, you know, true blood vampire people who run things and have run things into the ground. So yeah, they're not a one size fits all, but I think there are certain campaigns that they're just going to go bang and click right in.
Okay, well, good. For people like you that it works for, I'm glad it's there. You've converted me. Now, you've got the last section on races, which is really just going through some of the standard races, but explaining ways that Shadow could interplay with those races, like Dwarf and Aladrin, and what else do they have? Halflings, Elves, Humans. Is there Gnome? I thought there was Gnome, but I guess there's not. Okay, so it's basically the Player's Handbook 1 races, minus, what, Tieflings and Dragonborn, and explaining to you sort of how they can interplay with the idea of Shadow and the Shadowfell and all that.
I really would have liked Shadow-themed replacement powers.
Uh-huh.
Like a Shadowfell version of Fae Step for the Aladrin would have been so awesome, right? You know, like things like, you know, or like a different version of, like, you know, Elven Accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? I agree. I think rather than giving us, what did they give us? Like basically two different, you call them organizations or hooks or stories or whatever to explain shadow versions of each race. I would have almost, like you said, I almost would have rather had one concept and just a little tiny mechanical widget to make it feel shadowy.
Right.
Although I really like the art of the Aladrin on 133.
Oh, that's great.
Tracy, what do you think?
Probably could have used more. I don't know. I liked the organizations, though, because I'm always looking for those things for my game. But that's more of a DM thing than a player thing.
Okay, that's fair. In terms of, I think that's a good point, too, is that we're trying to figure out, is this a book for players, is this a book for players and DMs? Obviously it's for players, but is it for players and DMs? And it looks like there's some things here that might be more useful to DMs. The question we'll have to ask ourselves at the end is there enough of it to make it worth it for a DM to buy the book? Let's get to the last chapter, Shadow Options. So, first of all, explain to me the first, two pages here, where it talks about paths of shadow. And it's just talking about shadow paragon paths and epic destinies. Given that by the time you're reading this book, you have already played D&D, do we need them to explain to us how epic destinies and paragon paths work?
If you like things reinforced.
Okay.
Good point, though.
I mean, I just sort of, I looked at that and I'm like, I didn't quite understand why that was there. Like, why couldn't they just say, you know what, this is the section on paragon paths, and then just give us the paragon paths?
Since I've never played paragon or epic level, I sometimes forget what those things are. Like, I know they exist somewhere out there in the ether, and I'll get to them eventually, but I have never actually used them. So not having to go to another book, as long as they keep the text pretty small, like, they don't go on and on about it, it helps me a bit, but I could see that annoying people.
Well, I mean, it's the rules and the ideas are already explained, you know, in multiple locations now, in both of the Essentials books and in the Player's Handbook. I feel like it's well-trod ground. And if you don't play in those tiers, then, well, then first of all, this whole section isn't that particularly important to you. But second of all, when you get to that point, you have the reference material available. I don't know. It seemed unnecessary. But let's get into what this section's really about. If you count pages, I'm guessing this whole section's really about Paragon paths, because there's a lot of Paragon paths.
Yeah.
Any Paragon paths that stood out as particularly awesome or particularly not awesome? So we're all pretty underwhelmed by Paragon paths then, huh?
I will make a note that it was nice seeing the Shadow Dancer make an appearance.
And the Shadow Thief as well.
Yeah. It was nice seeing them sort of pop up, say hello. It was like saying hello to an old friend who I never really talked to much anyways, but, you know.
Right, exactly. I feel exactly the same way.
You just want to say something, not to feel awkward. So, you know, it's like, hi, guys.
Right. Well, and Paragon Paths and Epic Destinies in the same vein, I think, are one of those things where the more options I have, the better. You know, because who knows, when I get to that point in my character's career, I want to go through all the options I have and figure out which one makes the most story sense to my character. And so the more stories I have to choose from, the more little Paragon Paths or Epic Destinies I have to choose from, the better. Right? Because the more options I have and the more directions I can take my story.
Pretty much.
I really found that when my players hit Epic Tier, because there's considerably fewer Epic Destinies than there are Paragon Paths. But I really drove in the story elements of, as a DM, I really drove the story elements of those Epic Destinies into the game and into the story and the campaign. And so having more of those options and having more things to pull from, I think, is good. There's nothing here that sort of blew my head open, you know? But the idea of having these options and having those around, I think, is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody agrees with me, because I'm brilliant.
Yep. Pretty much.
All right. Then there's only one other section, and it's feats. And not very many of them. It's basically feats to support the shadowy stuff, right? Feats.
Yep.
A lot of them are racial feats to support your new shadowy races. Or otherwise, they're feats to support the concept of shadow in your game.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Frozen Soul seemed particularly awesome. Gaining cold resistance and a bonus to will, and they both scale.
Ooh, that is nice. Yeah, that's pretty good.
With a prerequisite that's not horribly difficult to meet, either a 13 in con or a 13 in wisdom.
Yeah, that's pretty nice.
But otherwise, I think that's Heroes of Shadow. Final thoughts?
Tracy, you want to go?
I don't know. I think more like what we were saying earlier, sometimes I wonder who the book's for. But I liked it, but I felt a lot of the stuff was more DM-oriented or something the DM should have control over.
I think that's fair, and at the same time, I don't think there's enough there to make it a DM book. There's not enough there for DMs to make it a DM book, or to make it a book that's meant for both. Like, it's definitely meant for players, and they just got a little bit of DM-iness stuck into it.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I like a lot of the contents that's in it. I just feel like thematically it didn't, though there was stuff that was shadow, it just didn't feel like it held together as like a real shadow book, you know. Yeah. That you know, it just didn't evoke that to me. You know, it was sort of darkish in the classes that it had, I guess. But I really found myself looking for just a touch more flavor and sort of theme orientedness on it. But, you know, again, sort of as a book, as specifically Heroes of Shadow, you know, I think it could use more theme, but as like a collection of cool player options, I think it's pretty cool, right? You know, if you're, I'm mostly a GM myself, but I know a lot of people who really like the content, players who like the content in here.
Yeah, and I think they've done a decent job of providing options. You know, they've given me some new ways to do things, and some of the things I have don't have a lot of options to them, you know. There's not a lot of variety in a vampire build. You know, you're going to have to work really hard to make two vampires that feel really different. But at the same time, I also feel like, you know what? If that vampire concept doesn't work for me at this point in the game, I have a lot of other choices I can make. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go a lot of other ways. And I can even go a lot of other ways and still capture a vampire-ish feel by going with certain race choices or feat choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I don't mind there being, at this point, some classes that have fewer options, because if I don't like those options, I'll go play something different. And that's okay.
The other thing I think of, I mean, I really like the book in the aspect of, I think it starts to show some of the other stuff we can do with 4th edition D&D, and that's the part like I really love about it. And so that, in that way, I'm really glad to have it. It's out there. Sometimes I feel a little bit like it's just a bunch of interesting DDI articles put together in a book.
Which is actually kind of unfortunate, right? Because the whole point of them scaling back the production was to make sure that everything they gave us was going to be the best. And it sounds to me like we don't necessarily feel like that happened here. Now, part of me says that's because I still feel like I'm reading the player's guide version. And when you combine it with the Shadowfell box set that comes out shortly, that will fix a lot of that. And I guess we won't know until next month when we do a review of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the other part, too, is that I don't know with this particular book how rushed it was compared to what they expect to do in the future.
That's true. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I think we've talked about Heroes of Shadow pretty well at this point. I want to take a quick break and talk about our second sponsor of the episode, The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits. If you're looking to add some new fun to your game, adding in crazy critical fumbles or crazy critical hits, whether it be monsters or magic or swords, there are some insane things that could happen. They had to actually develop entirely new monsters and magic items to represent the crazy stuff that could happen just because you rolled the right set of critical hits or critical fumbles. You can check that book out, available on Amazon, and I don't know if I mentioned it before, but it is also available on RPG Now in PDF form, and we will make sure to link those in the show notes.
The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits, from Unknown Tome Publishing. A 4th edition D&D supplement for all levels, featuring 63 new unique treasures, including 6 item sets and 28 new hazards and terrain powers. The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits will have you critting and fumbling your way into D&D gold. Visit our website to pick up this product in print or as a PDF.
All right, well, that is episode 173. We want to thank our sponsors for the episode, Noble Knight Games, as well as the Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits.
We also want to thank our guest, Quinn Murphy. Quinn, where can people find you?
You can find me on @will, 4E at will, .net, all one word. And we are just doing all sorts of crazy stuff with 4E, for lack of a better term. So it's a lot of fun. Come check us out.
Are we basically down to 3 contributors sort of headlining all that stuff right now?
Well, we've got you.
Right. And I'm fantastic. So that's, we all know that.
Yep. We've got Riven Sedril, rocking the stuff. Check out, he's doing, so we're very theme crazy over at @will right now. So, Riven's doing, he's multi-class Mondays. We're doing, multi-class themes and, he's doing them. You know, after we're talking about him, he just wants to do the whole thing. So he's doing like multi-class themes for pretty much all the classes every Monday. Uh-huh. And then we're just going through, my big kick right now is, talking about, running 4E with like low to near zero prep time is my big obsession right now. And I'm having lots of fun with that. And then we also have D&D Jester from he does a lot of blogging on a wizard site, and he's doing aquatic rules for 4E.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And I'm doing my new series is Lessons from Behind the Screen, where I'm actually, when I design stuff for my own game, I'm just sort of saying, here's the story behind what I'm doing, and here's how I did it mechanically, and then I actually go out and play it, and then I come back and do sort of a post-mortem of, here's how it went, and here's how I would have changed the design. And it's my way of sort of, I'm as a DM, I'm constantly trying out new ideas and new things in my either encounter design or monster design. This is my way of sort of going through some of the tricks and things that I try in my design.
Yeah, and that's great. It's really cool sort of being able to sort of share and see, you know, sort of like, okay, here's what went into this session of prep. And, you know, and how it worked.
Well, and more than once, I think it's actually made my game better, because there are times where it's like, you know what, I'm doing my prep and I know I need this creature or whatever. I'll just, you know, make this up or whatever. I'll just wait, and I come up with something easy. And it's like, you know, no, I'm not going to take the easy way out. I'm going to turn this into an @will article, and I'm going to force myself to try to find an interesting way to accomplish what I want to accomplish. And so I actually end up, I think, getting better games out of it as well.
Nice. I'm glad the site can contribute to you, like pretty directly to you having a better game.
That's absolutely awesome. And Riven as well. He's a player in my game.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Everybody can find Quinn over there at Will, which is 4eatwill.net. That's how I always remember it. Or 4eatwill, however you want to do it. And you can get a hold of us at The Tome Show by emailing thetomeshow@gmail.com or visiting the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com. You can call up The Tome's biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for upcoming episodes. Or maybe you have a thought about what the crazy things we said in this episode. You want to argue with us or agree, whichever one. Call us up.
And talking about getting in contact with us, be sure to enter the Tome's New Life contest for April by swinging by the forums to talk about your favorite plane to travel to and why, and by calling the Tome's biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME and tell us about any questions you have about the Shadowfell, and we'll include some of those in the upcoming episode.
Speaking of which, Quinn, what's your favorite plane to visit?
Plane to visit? The plane of house ruling madness.
Okay, but what's your favorite plane to visit in D&D?
Oh, okay. you're going to make me play by the rules. Okay, I'm actually a huge fan of the Shadowfell.
Right on. Tracy, what's your favorite plane to visit?
Does the Feywild count?
Yes, it does.
Then that's where I'd go.
I'm a big fan of Hell. You know, whichever. But yeah, I like devils, so I like going to Hell, so to speak. All right. And of course, we're talking Shadowfell in this episode, and we'll be talking Shadowfell next month as well, which is why we want to hear your questions about the Shadowfell. Maybe you have questions about how to use the Shadowfell in your game, questions about, you know, what kind of things might be there, any questions you might have about the Shadowfell or the Shadowfell book for us to discuss in that episode. Send them along. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products we discussed in the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and every little bit helps us stay strong. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com.
And this has been episode 173, where we swore an oath to the Raven Queen, gained healing surges as only a vampire knows how, and deftly applied poison to our assassin's blade in this episode of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.